Don't wait. Get this limited-time holiday offer only from Fios. Click the banner to get incredibly fast 150-meg internet, TV, and phone for only $79.99 per month online for the first year. Plus, you'll get a $200 Visa prepaid card with a 2-year agreement. This offer is now extended to December 16th.
Blog Talk Radio. Hi, welcome everybody. This is syndicated columnist Amy Alcon with Advice Goddess Radio. Nerd your way to a better life with the best brains in science. And all that moaning in our opening was very appropriate because this is a show about sex tonight. There's a cliche that good sex is all in your head. Now, people say that, and other people nod when they say that, but then everybody goes ahead thinking all the wrong things in bed, all the things that make them anxious and lead to sex that leaves them feeling unhappy, unsatisfied, and even ashamed. But they're actually too ashamed to admit that. And I have to say, no, this isn't just a show about other people who feel these things. Chances are, while listening to this show tonight, you'll be surprised at the number of things you can identify with that are making your sex life a lot less than it could be. And you're doing that thanks to how you've been buying into myths that we all buy into. They're big cultural myths. And I just want an hour of your time, and I think we can change that, because my guest tonight is therapist and sex therapist Dr. Marty Klein. He's author of a really wonderful new book, Sexual Intelligence, What We Really Want from Sex and How to Get It. Stay with us as he rips away a lot of damaging thinking about sex to help you put the fog back on your car windows and everywhere else. Hello, Marty.
Hello, Amy.
So you write in your book that sex isn't just an activity, it's an idea. What does that mean?
As I've sat through 31,000 sessions of sex therapy and psychotherapy and couples counseling, what I notice is that the way that people relate to each other sexually is invariably an expression of their ideas about sexuality, their ideas about gender, their ideas about what is real sex as opposed to just foreplay, what is real sex as opposed to second-best sex. And the ideas that people have about sexuality really shape the decisions that they make and the behaviors that they consider appropriate or inappropriate.
And you say this amazing thing in your book. You say that people learn about sex when they have a young person's body and then expect it to continue the same way.
Absolutely. You know, most of us, we learn about sex when we're growing up, and we sort of solidify our ideas about what does it mean to be sexual, what is good sex, what is a real man, what is a real woman. That stuff tends to solidify when we have our early sexual experiences in young adulthood, late adolescence, young adulthood. So by the time most people are about 22, in the West, people about 22, 23, people feel like they know what sex is all about. When you're 35 years old, let's say, you have a completely different body. You have completely different interests. It's kind of like learning to drink the cheapest wine available when you're 18 years old. When you get to be 25 or 30, you have a little bit more taste, a little bit more sophistication. You don't want that cheap junk anymore.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing. This is something that you do throughout the book. You show people how to enjoy sex with the body they have, the partner they have. And really, I mean, we see this stuff in the movies. It's always, you know, somebody who's actually a body double of an actress, you know, having sex, some like 21-year-old hottie. And that's our view. And I think we're very colored by that, our view.
Oh, of course. And, you know, as we get to be 30 or 35 or 40, most of us, our body is not going back. Our body at 38 years old is not going back to the way it was when it was 20. Whether it's our ability to get erections when we've been drinking, whether it's our ability to wake up and go to work after only sleeping for 4 hours, whether it's the ability to be lubricated just because you see somebody taking off their shirt. So we really have to sort of keep track of the way that our body changes over time so that we can continually adjust our expectations of sex and our ideas about what good sex consists of.
You write about this great couple, Thomas and Danny, and they were very stressed about, you know, trying to have fantastic sex. And I love you advise them to have an attitude about sex that they did toward other things, like house projects.
Yeah. You know, there's this exceptionalism around sexuality in America and in Western culture that that the rules for everyday living don't apply to sex. And if you want to create great sex, you need to refer to this completely separate body of wisdom. And all the things that we know about conflict resolution, all the things we know about sharing, all the things we know about taking turns, all the things we know about decision making, all the things we know about how to have fun, with this idea that sex is different from everything else, we don't use all those things that we already know or that we've already learned. And so people actually come to me and they say, what should I do if I have to go to the bathroom in the middle of sex? Nobody says, what should I do if I have to go to the bathroom in the middle of watching the Super Bowl? Nobody asks me that question. Nobody says, what should I do if I have to go to the bathroom in the middle of listening to Amy Alcon's program? You know, nobody wonders about that. But people actually wonder. People actually wonder, what should I do if I have to go to the bathroom in the middle of sex? Or what should I do if my feet are really, really cold while I'm having sex?
I want the answers to both of those. I don't mean to stop you, but I want the – what about the bathroom one? What do you do?
You look at your partner and you say, honey, don't finish without me. I'll be right back. And you go to the bathroom.
Okay. Sort of like the Super Bowl.
And wash your hands afterwards.
That's funny. And what about if your feet are cold?
Well, what do you do if you're watching TV and your feet are cold? You put on socks. That's what you should do during sex. You put on socks. And people say, oh, wearing socks during sex is not sexy. Listen, anything that makes people more physically comfortable, anything that makes people more psychologically or emotionally relaxed, that's sexy. If it's socks, if it's closing the window, if it's opening the window, whatever makes people feel more comfortable during sex, it contributes to sex. So this whole idea, again, you know, when we talk about eating, you know, if I serve you dinner and the meal is too hot, you know what to do. You let it sit until it cools off. If I serve you food and it needs more salt, you know what to do. You put more salt on. When it comes to sex, people tend to let go of that perfectly logical, sensible attitude. And they'll say things like, well, my feet were cold, but I didn't want to put on socks because I didn't want him to think that I wasn't sexy. Well, if you're keeping your legs away from somebody else because you know your feet are freezing and you don't want the other person to jump out of bed, your feet are too cold, that's not sexy. So part of sexual intelligence is being willing to acknowledge, I know how to run my adult life, and I'm going to run my sex life the way I run my adult life. Or I don't know how to run my adult life, and I'm going to figure that out and then use those skills to run my sex life too.
Well, I want to ask you about sexual intelligence, but first I wanted to ask you, why are we these sexual mutes? We're these adults who can go around and ask for things and do things. We're mostly probably pretty effective. But then in bed, why do we just shut up and, you know, and take things we don't like?
That's such a good question. And I think partly it's that despite all of the talk about sex and all of the media and fashion and music and everything, sex, 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 I think a lot of people still don't feel really entitled to create exactly the sexual experience that they want to have. I think most people feel entitled to have some sort of sex, but I think that most people really believe that really great sex is for the young and beautiful, which is certainly not me either way. So most people feel that sex is for people who are young and beautiful and that they're not entirely eligible if they're not young and beautiful. And I think most people feel that really, really enjoyable sex is sort of a matter of dumb luck. It sort of falls on your shoulders like snow if you're lucky. And so the rest of us, we just have to sort of take what comes along. And what I tell people is, you know, the most important sentence in the English language is, a quarter of an inch to the left, please. And people have to learn how to say things like slow down, speed up, more to the left, more to the right, wait, 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 faster, faster. People are just hesitant to create designer sex. And part of what I do both clinically and in this book and all the other books I've written, I just encourage people, talk about the sex that you really want to have and then create it with the other person.
I just want to slow things down a little bit. See, I did that. Because that vocabulary you just put out there is so important. I learned this when I was doing some film stuff from a director, that you don't give an actor line readings, that you say slower, faster, louder, softer. And, you know, people think to direct their partner that it's all this uncomfortable language, but these words that you just said, slower, faster, you know, just these little, more there, that's good, you know, those little things, it doesn't have to be, you know, a dissertation. And I think it's really important for people to recognize that.
Yeah, I totally agree. I totally agree. And at the same time, if you're not willing to use words, you know, a lot of my patients, here's how they talk about sex. They say things like, I hope you'll do something great down there. You know, how much more vague could that be? Something great down there. So when I have patients who are embarrassed to use real words for sex, I say, imagine that you're cooking a meal and you're not allowed to use, the two of you together, you're cooking a meal together and you're not allowed to use any words for any of the ingredients, any words for any of the tools you're going to use, or any words for the actions that you're going to have. So you can't use the words saute or fry. You can't use the words coriander or oregano. You can't use the words frying pan. You can't use the word chop. You can't use the word boil, right? So what would it be like for two people to cook together without those words? I'd say, gee, honey, would you get that thing and do that thing with it over here? You know, it's complete. Or how about if you use a little of something or other over here? You know, it makes no sense to cook that way if you can't use real simple words like fry that or chop that or put that in the refrigerator. And yet, that's how a lot of people are attempting to have sex. They say, maybe you could, you know, or gee, I'd really like it if you would, well, you know what I mean. And if that's the way that people communicate about sex, communicating more is not going to help. If that's the way you communicate, don't bother doing more of that.
Now, I'm getting a little ahead of myself, but I just want to ask you this now. How do you help people who are communicating in that way to ask for things? You lay out the psychology, you know, throughout your book, Sexual Intelligence, but is there one simple thing you tell them to help them?
Everything I tell them is simple. Everything I do in my practice is simple. I say, what do you want? What's making it difficult for you to talk about it? People will say things like, the past haunts me. And I say, no, the past is not haunting you. You are haunting the past.
Wow, that's great.
I just had a couple the other day. She says, I hate when he looks me in the eye and talks to me, because that's what my father did. He looked at me and he criticized me. So I'd rather that when my husband talks to me, he doesn't look at me. I say, you know, that was 35 years ago. Isn't it time you got your father out of your marriage? Isn't it time that you put your father where he belongs? People say, well, it's not that simple. I say, actually, it is. The first step is to make a decision that you can do it. Most people aren't willing to do that. Make a decision that you can do it and then figure out how to do it. Most people say, since I don't know how to do it, I can't decide that I'm going to do it yet.
Yeah, that's very important. This is what I love about your book, and I'm going to do a little station ID, that you really make things simple and you lay out all these practical things. And this is not your typical self-help book. This is actually truly helpful. You make a fun. You have a great line in your book making fun of self-help books that I'll read, but I want to do a station ID. This is Amy Alcon's Advice Goddess Radio, Nerd Your Way to a Better Life with the best brains in psychology and research. Tonight's brain belongs to therapist and sex therapist Dr. Marty Klein, author of a very helpful new book, Sexual Intelligence, What We Really Want from Sex and How to Get It. Stay with us as he rips away numerous myths about sex to help you all have better sex lives. Call in to comment, to ask for advice, or to ask a question at 347-326-9761. That's 347-326-9761. Or you can ask a question in the chat room, and I will try to get to it. I want to just get to sexual intelligence, the definition of it. What is sexual intelligence?
Sexual intelligence involves the skills that we need to talk about what's important to us sexually. Sexual intelligence involves raw information, like how the clitoris works. Sexual intelligence involves a certain amount of body awareness so that you're able to direct your little fingers and your little toes to do what you want them to do. And you're able to have a sense of what your body is doing in space. So, for example, most of us, when we close our eyes, you could try, all of our listeners could try this, close your eyes and touch your nose with your finger. Most people can do that. Close your eyes, touch your, if you're sober, close your eyes, touch your nose with your finger. Most people can do that. Now the question is, can you stroke somebody's nipples exactly the way you intend to when your eyes are closed? Or can you touch someone in the way that they ask you to and the way you want to? Can you actually do that? For some people, they're so anxious about doing it right that the anxiety actually interferes with their fine motor control. And everybody who plays sports knows this phenomenon. You know, when you try and shoot a free throw with the game on the line, it's completely different than shooting a free throw in practice. And why is that? The difference is that when the game is on the line, we get anxious, and that affects our fine motor coordination. And so when you watch a game on TV, what do good players do when they go to the line to shoot a free throw? They take a few deep breaths, and they bounce the ball a half a dozen times. That's their attempt to get their anxiety under control. So paradoxically, what a lot of people are doing in bed is they're trying to perform well, and the desire to perform and the anxiety about their performance actually degrades their performance.
Yeah, it's very, very interesting. You write about this, how people are actually, they're trying to resolve the emotional needs they bring to sex by trying to create this amazing sex. And you say you can't have amazing sex when you're focused on these emotional needs.
Right, right. As long as people are trying to accomplish something with sex, it's going to be hard to just have sex. And it's like having a dinner party when you're trying to close a big business deal. You know, it becomes an entirely different enterprise. You hardly even taste the food because you're so focused on pulling off the perfect dinner party so that you will impress somebody so that they'll either give you a business contract or make a deal with you or something like that. So it's the same thing with sex. When we're too anxious about doing it right, it makes it hard to just relax and enjoy it and get value from it.
And so what's healthier, better thinking than you know, being so performance stricken?
Well, I think that sex really has no meaning. Sex has no meaning. We want sex to have meaning, and so we give it meaning. And you know, people can do that in a benign way. People can do that in a harmless way, or people can do that in a really self-destructive way. I hear over and over and over again that if I don't get an erection, it means I'm not a real man. Or if I can't make her climax, it means I'm not a real man. Or women who say, if I can't make him ejaculate inside of me, that means that I'm not a good lover or I'm not a real woman. Or it means that he doesn't find me really, really attractive. When people load these kinds of meanings onto what are essentially neutral, meaningless physical responses, that just gives sex way too much meaning, and it makes it really hard to just relax and enjoy it. It would be the equivalent of saying to somebody, oh, you like vanilla ice cream as opposed to chocolate ice cream. That means something about you. And then, you know, the whole activity of eating ice cream would become a lot more complicated. When you and I, Amy, when you and I go out for ice cream, you know, you can eat whatever flavor you like, and I'm not going to think, oh, very interesting. She likes Rocky Road. No. Ice cream is just ice cream. And we have to get to the point where sex is just sex. And if people want to have sex with love or people want to have sex with intimacy, that's great. But if people want to pretend that sex has some objective meaning about their masculinity or their femininity or their adequacy as people. That's just a big mistake.
One of the wonderful things in your book, Sexual Intelligence, is how you talk about how hung up people are on being sexually normal. So first, what is normal sex supposed to be?
Well, I can tell you what people think normal sex is. It's some number of times per week or some number of times per month. It's, you know, some amount of how long it takes before you get an erection or how long it takes before you have an orgasm or how many orgasms you have or can you climax together. Climaxing together always sounds to me about as simple as singing underwater. It sounds so complicated. And I just can't see that it's worth the effort. But so when people think about normal sex, they think about all these objective measures. And people are forever saying, okay, Marty, you're an expert. You tell me, you know, how many times a week is normal for newlyweds? How many orgasms a week is normal for a single guy? You know, is it normal to masturbate if you've been married for 5 years? I don't get involved in these questions about what's normal. I never think that it's a good idea to compare yourself to some objective standard when it comes to sex.
What do you tell people when they ask you these questions?
That's what I tell them. I say, you know, what's normal is everybody wants to feel normal, and what's normal is everybody asks me what's normal, and I'm not telling. People say, well, you're an expert. What do you mean you don't know? I say, oh, I know. I can tell you, you know, how much the average newlywed couple have sex or how much, you know, the average African-American man, you know, is interested in oral sex or whatever it is. We have those statistics, but they're pointless. You know, when people say, you know, what's sexually normal, I say, well, if you really push me, if you really, really push me, I'll tell you what's normal. Most adults have sex when they're tired. That's what's normal, having sex when you're tired. And that has a huge impact on the kinds of sexual experiences that people have.
You actually, there's this wonderful bit in the section about quote unquote normal sex. You say that this leads to emotional isolation. Emotional isolation. And there's this great quote where you say, "In this state, farting or wetting the bed is a tragedy."
Yes, yes, yes. It's so interesting that when people are trying to be normal, whatever it is that they imagine is normal, anything that's not normal is this big horrible thing. You know, if you and I go out to lunch and I knock over my glass of water, it's a nuisance, but we both get over it pretty quickly. But if I go to lunch with you and I'm trying to impress you into thinking that I'm really graceful and you should hire me for your baseball team, and I knock over my glass of water, you're going to think, oh, he's one of those clumsy guys. Forget it. And, oh, it'll be a big tragedy that I knocked over my glass of water. So that's what people are doing with sex. They're so so concerned. They're so anxious. You know, my first book, I called this normality anxiety. They're so anxious about being normal sexually that once they get a picture of what's normal sexually, whatever it is, whatever that picture is, once people get a picture of what that is, anything that they do or that their partner does that does not conform to that picture, oh, that's a big, big problem.
Yeah, it's so ridiculous, and I love how you just debunk so much in your book. Let me do a little station ID so I tell people about your book. This is Amy Alcon's Advice Goddess Radio. I'm talking with sex therapist Dr. Marty Klein, author of this terrific book, Sexual Intelligence, What We Really Want from Sex and How to Get It. I somehow can't speak tonight too well. It's sex. It does it to me. I'm speechless. And we're going to continue debunking myths. And I just love how different your book is from other self-help books. And there are these expectations that people have that their sex life stays the same as it was during simpler times in their lives. And as somebody who loves realism, I just love that you made fun of this book title. This is what all the other books are like. Have sex like you just met, no matter how long you've been together. You know, and this is not the reality. And you give this example of this couple, Margot and Dane, who stopped having sex, and they remembered when it would just happen, but they had a kid, and he was working 12-hour days. And so what was their situation, and what did you do for them?
Oh, I haven't read the book in a while.
Okay. Okay. Well, basically, what they expected their sex life to be, they met really when they were really young, and they expected their sex life to be an hour or two like it used to be, and they felt like failures because they were, you know, they had a kid and the job and the this and the that.
Yeah.
So that's some of the stuff about the normal, quote-unquote, that you're writing about.
Yeah, and you know... In other parts of life, most people realize that things change when you go from being a college student to being an adult with a job to being in a couple with family responsibilities. Most people know that once you have a job and a kid, you're probably not going to go out drinking and clubbing on a Wednesday night until 3 o'clock in the morning. Most people understand that. Most people understand that when you have a job and a kid, you're probably not going to bring four people home for dinner on a Tuesday night without letting your partner know ahead of time and then invite them to just crash in the living room. You know, most people know that. But when it comes to sex, because there's this exceptionalism, people don't seem to realize or to accept that sex is going to be different after you couple up or after you have a kid or after you have a job or after you have back pain or whatever it is. People don't seem to appreciate that sex is going to change. And it's going to change, and the only choices that we have are, do we want to participate in shaping those changes or not? Do we want to label those changes a disaster or not? Do we want to consider ourselves no longer eligible for good sex, or do we just change the definition of good sex?
Yeah, it's very, very interesting how people have hung on to these sort of these damaging beliefs. And you talk about how people what people say they want from sex and what they really want are two different things. So first, tell us, what do people say they want from sex?
Well, just about everybody says they want some combination of pleasure and closeness. Some people want more pleasure. Some people want more closeness. A lot of people want a bunch of both. A lot of people say they want some combination of pleasure and closeness, but that's not what some people actually focus on during sex. They focus on, I hope I get hard enough, I hope I get hard quick enough, I hope I last long enough, I hope I don't call out the wrong name when I climax, I hope I don't wet the bed, I hope I'm as good in bed as my partner's last girlfriend. So people are focusing on a lot of extraneous stuff. People are focusing on, I hope he doesn't notice that I've gained 5 pounds. People are focused on, I hope she doesn't notice that I got a big belly or I got a big butt or I got a hairy butt or whatever it is. People are really focused on lots of extraneous stuff. And as long as people focus on extraneous stuff, it's more difficult to feel the closeness during sex and it's more difficult to feel the pleasure during sex. That makes perfect sense, doesn't it?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And you say a big part of the problem is that people don't inform themselves or their partner of their actual agenda, and then it doesn't get fulfilled, and then they're resentful.
Right. Right. And, you know, if you're in bed to prove to your mother that you're okay, or if you're in bed to prove to yourself that you're a real woman, or if you're in bed to prove that your ex-husband was a jerk, then most people are not going to admit that to themselves, and most people who admit that to themselves are not going to admit that to the person they're in bed with. But they're proceeding with those agendas anyway, and it really trivializes sex to use it in that kind of a way. You know, sex can be a really nice thing. It can last, you know, 15 minutes, 20 minutes, half hour, and for most people, it's a chance to go on vacation and to not have a lot of rules and to be in a space where it doesn't matter what happens, which most adults, we don't have too many places like that, where it just doesn't matter what happens, right? Even when you play tennis, it matters what happens. You hit the ball outside the lines, you know you're out. You drive, you run a red light, it really matters if you run a red light. So for most adults, what sex has to offer is, you know, you get to go someplace with somebody you kind of like, for 25 minutes, 30 minutes, you relax, you do some stuff, you feel close to the person or not, you have pleasure with the other person or not, then you're done, thank you very much, goodbye. that's what sex has to offer for most adults most of the time. Every once in a while, it's a little more special than that. But that's a real nice thing. That's a real nice thing. When people trivialize it into some sort of mechanical counting the number of orgasms or counting the number of minutes before you get an erection, that's just wasting an opportunity.
And I, one thing I love about your book is that you're a, you help people be a lot less orgasm and intercourse focused. As a, you know, people see these things, the orgasm and intercourse, as the only kind of sex, as a holy grail. And you talked about the 68-year-old guy who had this new girlfriend, and they were, you know, sexual in a bunch of different ways, but he didn't want intercourse, and his girlfriend did, and she had some counselor, and the counselor said he was probably afraid of intimacy, blah blah blah, and you asked him this really wonderful, unexpected question. Why should you want intercourse?
Yeah. Yeah, I remember that. That one I remember real clearly. And I this case comes around periodically with me, you know, guys coming in or women coming in, you know, in tears. Why don't I want to screw? And my answer is, why should you? You know, if you don't want to make a baby, there's nothing special about intercourse. There's a lot of ways to have sex. And every way has its advantages and every way has its disadvantages. But there's nothing, if you don't want to conceive, which most people don't when they have sex, if you don't want to conceive, there's no reason that you should have intercourse at all. People say, well, it's the most intimate kind of sex. Well, first of all, not everybody wants the most intimate kind of sex. And second of all, not necessarily. A lot of people have way more intimate sex when they're having oral sex. A lot of people have way more intimate sex when they're stroking themselves and looking at each other's eyes. A lot of people have much more intimate sex when they're just tongue kissing. You want to know what's really intimate? I think what's really intimate is tongue kissing, as proven by the fact that people will have intercourse with people, with other people, when they're mad with them, when they're angry with them. Most people will not tongue kiss when they're angry.
Right.
So that's what
yeah.
makes me think. That's what makes me think that tongue kissing is pretty intimate.
No, I definitely agree with you. And it's so. There are a lot of sad stories in your book about people who, you know, they just have so many myths that they cling to. And there is one story. Let me see if I can find it. Oh, people don't talk to each other is another thing. There's a guy who really, really needed to hear that he was the best lover, you know, that he had this sexually experienced girlfriend. But you said that he never told her this in a simple, straightforward way. I mean, people expect each other to be sexual psychics.
Yeah, and you know, this whole idea, I want to be the best lover you ever had, that's a real mistake. That's a real invitation to trouble. I mean, first of all, nobody can be the best lover that everybody's ever had. You know, that, you know, numerically, that just wouldn't work out. But you know, the whole idea, I want to be the best lover you ever had. You know, when you go and you construct your, you know, the mate that you're looking for, when you ask people what's important, you know, a lot of people say, oh, I want us to have sexual compatibility or sexual chemistry. But, you know, if you said to most people, how about if this person, if you and this person have, you know, reasonably good sex and they're a great parent, or they have a great sense of humor, or they have a lot of money, or they're a great Scrabble player, or they're a great cook. You know, a lot of people very reasonably would say, well, you know, I wouldn't want a complete idiot in bed, but, you know, if they're reasonably competent, they don't have to be the best one I ever had, but if they're reasonably, you know, present during sex, and they're a great cook, hey, that's what I want. Forget about the best sex I ever had. Halfway decent sex and a good cook, sign me up.
This brings me to bad sexual dynamics, the ooh, he jabbed his tongue down my throat thing. What do you do when the sexual dynamics aren't just, okay, that's fine, you know, and he plays great Scrabble, but this is really bad. I like him or I like her, but, you know, in bed, you know, there's got to be some training here. What's the answer to that?
I think that every pair of people trains each other. You know, whether you're in a 20-year marriage or whether you're 4 months of dating, people train each other. People train each other into, no, honey, we don't pee with the door open. Or, no, honey, we do pee with the door open. People train each other. No, honey, when you want to watch TV at 4 o'clock in the morning while I'm asleep, no, you don't get to do that. Or if you're going to do that, you have to go into the other room or you have to use headphones or whatever it is. People train each other. no, I'm not going to go to the supermarket without a bra just because it turns you on. Or whatever it is. You know, people train each other. I don't like sushi today. I didn't like it yesterday. I'm not going to like it tomorrow. You can quit asking. We'll go to any other kind of restaurant you want, but you can quit asking for sushi. Have sushi with your friend.
Was that a euphemism for anal sex?
No. No, that is not a euphemism.
I know.
I have no problem saying cunnilingus, oral sex, going down, eating pussy. I got no trouble saying that.
No, I'm just
so.
I know that about you. I want to ask you, though, this is the thing I get some questions about. What is the language, for example, that you use to transform a bad kisser? Because there are relationships that end over this.
Well, there are no bad kissers. There's only people who kiss in ways that you don't like. You know, your bad kisser could be somebody else's great kisser, right? You know, your lousy TV show could be somebody else's Emmy Award winner. So, I mean, I agree there are people that I wouldn't want to kiss a second time either. So what you do is you talk to somebody. And one of the main reasons for so-called lousy kissing is that people are so anxious. People are so anxious about getting it right, or people are so excited that they're actually going to get to kiss an actual girl. Oh, my God. You know, people just get either too excited or too anxious, and they're not emotionally present. They're not actually feeling what's going on physically. That's what I mean by that bodily awareness thing being the third prong, if you will, the third aspect of sexual intelligence, right? So a lot of people, they're so concerned about kissing you right that they'll do things like they'll shove their tongue down your throat, or they'll pull your hair, or they won't brush their teeth first, or whatever it is, because they're really not paying attention to the actual experience. They're way too wrapped up in their anxiety or their excitement. So where we start with that stuff is, whoa, slow down and let's get emotionally present. Let's get you focused on, can you look in the person's eyes? You know, can you smell their hair? Can you stroke their face without poking them in the eye? You know, can you actually relax during sex or relax during erotic play rather than get all revved up? I think the role of relaxation in sex is underplayed. It's misunderstood. I think that looking at sex as a form of relaxation, ultimately for most people, is a lot better than looking at sex as a focus of excitement.
This is what I love about your book. There's just such realism in it, and you had this great line about the problem with most self-help books, you say, is that they're prescriptive. They tell people exactly what kind of sex they should have and then tell them how they should have it. And you tell people, your book is all about realism, about relaxing, about how to enjoy sex with the body you have, and instead of worrying about the body that you no longer have. And I should do a little station ID now, just tell people about your book. This is Amy Elkhorn's Advice Goddess Radio, Nerd Your Way to a Better Life with the best brains in psychology and research. Tonight's brain belongs to therapist and sex therapist Dr. Marty Klein, author of the new book Sexual Intelligence, What We Really Want from Sex and How to Get It. His website is sexed.org, or he says sexed.org, but it's spelled like sexed, S-E-X-E-D.org. And call in to comment, to ask for advice, or to ask a question, 347-326-9761. That's 347-326-9761. Squeamish Americans, no one's calling in. And I should also say, Marty has a great book out also. He is a civil libertarian like me. America's War on Sex, The Continuing Attack on Law, Lust, and Liberty is his excellent other book that he has out with a foreword by Nadine Strossen from the ACLU. And I really am happy you've written that and can't wait to finish reading it. I just started it. So the next question I want to ask you, this very, very interesting thing you bring up in your book, you ask about people's willingness to initiate sex rather than their willingness to have it.
Right. Yeah, you know, as a sex therapist and as a marriage counselor and as a psychotherapist, I'm continually asking people questions about sexuality. And, you know, the trick is to ask people valuable questions, not just questions that they're going to be willing to answer, but questions that when they answer them, the answers mean something. So I don't want to just know about people's willingness to have sex. Because it's easy to say, oh, yeah, I would do it, but rather the willingness to initiate, the willingness to bridge the gap between not having sex and having sex, or doing stuff that people don't consider to be sex, and then stuff that people consider to be sex. So there's, you know, in the early stages of sexual relationships, if the sex is really hot, if you ask most people, look at each other and laugh, and they say, nobody does. It just happens. And I think under the best of circumstances, particularly at the beginning of a hot new relationship, yeah, sex just happens. But as people become accustomed to each other, as the sex becomes a little less exciting or a little less hot, couples run into the problem of, okay, who's going to initiate? And for a lot of people, they say, well, you know, once I'm in it, I'm fine, but getting into it is the problem for me. So I want to know from people, how willing are you to initiate, and what makes it easier to initiate, and what makes it harder to initiate. And there's so much information wrapped up in the difficulties that people have simply approaching their partner, saying, I desire sex and that's okay, I desire you and I'm not afraid to admit that, saying, I think that spending time having sex is a good use of time, not a waste of time. And for some people, you know, it's not just sex that they have trouble initiating, it's any kind of relaxation or play or recreation. They also don't say to their partners, you know what, I've had enough email, let's go for a walk around the block. You know, a lot of people not willing to do that either. So I want to know what makes it easy and what makes it difficult for people to actually say, I choose sex now. Not I'm willing, but I choose.
And so much of this seems to come out of a relationship, and you make this point that couples need to lay a foundation of treating each other well before they can address sex. And you have this great little list of things, and part of it is how you treat yourself. And so some of the things are that you comfort yourself when you're frustrated, and that you give your mate the benefit of the doubt, and that when you're hurt, redefining the other person as uninformed rather than uncaring. These are all so great. Two more, imagining how you sound to your mate before you say something and striving to understand your mate before striving to be understood. And these are these basic things. And this is one thing I love about your book, Sexual Intelligence, that you do lay out things simply. And these are really, you give all these basics. And people say these things, yeah, you need to have a good relationship. But those things, really a lot of them amount to having empathy both for yourself and for your partner. And I think if you're empathetic, that the other person, even if you're doing something wrong or they're annoyed, it lays a different foundation than if you're just, you know, me against you.
You're absolutely right. And empathy, of course, is just critical in relationships, and whether they're sexual or not. But empathy really allows people, or giving somebody else the benefit of the doubt, really allows people to keep their pilot light on. You know, what you don't want is for the pilot light in a sexual relationship to go out. And then you have to, if you're going to have sex, you have to start really from a cold engine. You have to start really from scratch. Whereas if the pilot light is lit, if people trust each other most of the time, if people can be annoyed without having to push the other person away, if people can feel disappointed without feeling insulted, if people can feel disappointed without assuming that somebody did something wrong, these are the kinds of things that allow people in relationships to maintain their connection so that when there could be a sexual space, the relationship is ready for it. But if you have to build a relationship at the very same time that you're initiating sex, that's just too much all at the same time. So what you want is to be taking care of the relationship along the way so that when it's possible to have sex, all it is sex. You don't have to do any repair work at the same time that you're initiating sex or having sex.
I have a very simple line about this, and it's don't ever act like you forgot that you love your partner. And if you just behave that way, we're all annoying and get annoyed and everything like that, but there's a certain line that gets crossed, I think, in relationships where people get really ugly toward each other, and you can be annoyed. And there are people that are more vocal in arguments, but, you know, to never sort of really, you know, go for the low blows, then I think you maintain a different kind of relationship, and you don't have the pilot light that goes out.
I agree with you, and I love the way that you put that. I put it in a slightly different way, but it's the same idea. You know, when people are arguing, what I tell them is, you can argue as viciously as you want, as long as you're absolutely certain that this is the last argument you're ever going to have. But if you're planning to sleep in the same bed with this person, you better argue in a way so that you can get into the same bed tonight.
Wow, that's amazing. I have a comment in the chat room here. It says, I didn't enjoy kissing for a long time because of multiple dental problems. And this is something you deal with a lot of this in your book about people who have parts of their body that aren't working anymore or fat or they're hairy. What do you tell somebody like that?
Well, give me the question again.
I have trouble enjoying kissing
because of a dental problem.
Because I had multiple dental problems.
Yeah, well, I, step one, know that about yourself. Step two, talk to your partner about that. Sweetheart, don't take this personally. This is about me, not about you. So let's creep up on it slowly. Let's do kissing on the face instead of kissing inside the mouth. You know, let's do kissing on the body instead of kissing on the mouth. Let's get used to me using my mouth in a way that doesn't feel so challenging. And, you know, there's a lot of places to kiss a person beside their mouth. Some of them can be very entertaining. And the thing is, the other person has to not take it personally. When someone looks them in the eye and say, trust me, this is a long-standing issue with me about dental stuff. This is not about you. This is not a rejection of you. The other person needs to say, oh, this is not a rejection of me. Okay, let's go to plan B. What would that be? You want to kiss my face? Great. You want to kiss my nipples? Great. I guess you're not going to kiss my mouth for a while. If ever. And I think that as long as people don't assign any meaning to this, they can use their creativity to come up with custom designed sex that works.
This is what I love about your book, Sexual Intelligence, and I'm talking with Dr. Marty Klein, therapist and sex therapist, that you help people verbalize these things. And I see this from the people who write to me. So many people are so hurt and resentful because they're expecting another person to be a mind reader. And by just telling the person, look, it's my dental issues. It's not that I don't want to kiss you. I'm embarrassed. I've got to get to the dentist. I've got to earn, you know, $1,900 to get my teeth fixed or whatever. And until then, we'll kiss elsewhere. That just solves a host of issues or keeps them from coming up and keeps people from being hurt.
Yeah. Yeah, not taking things personally, it's a real skill, and relationships really require that people continually choose to not take it personally. Every once in a while it's personal, in which case you should take it personally. But most of the time it's not personal, and taking it personally really gets in the way.
You know, you say something very interesting, that when it comes to sex, each of us has a narrative, one that answers fundamental questions about our identity. What does that mean?
Well, a narrative is simply a way of stitching together facts, and everybody has multiple narratives. Everybody has a story about how they got where they are and who they are. Everybody has a story that makes sense out of the past. In fact, we have narratives going on every day. Just to take a real simple example, if you wake up Monday morning and the first thing that happens to you Monday morning is you knock over your cup of coffee, what most people say is, oh, it's going to be one of those days. Then you get on the freeway to drive to work, and there's a lot of traffic, and you're late for work. And what most people say is, see, I knew it was going to be one of those days. So that's a narrative. It's a narrative that stitches together the completely disparate facts of a knocked over cup of coffee and traffic on the freeway. And that's what human beings do. We are meaning-making animals. And so, for example, somebody will be perfectly fine sexually, and then one night they won't get an erection. And then four nights later, they won't get an erection. And they say to themselves, uh-oh, I'm impotent, or uh-oh, I have ED. And that's a big mistake, but it's a real common thing. Or somebody will, a woman will be with a guy for a few months sexually, and the guy she won't have an orgasm with the guy. Then she'll be with another guy, and she won't have orgasm with that guy. And then what she'll say is, oh, I'm one of those women who doesn't have orgasms. Stitching together those two experiences into a story that tells her what her identity is. And when we do that with sex, it's almost invariably a mistake. People need to exercise discipline and not tell stories about themselves, particularly stories that undermine who they are. You know, I'm no good at this sex thing, or I'm not one of these women who's great in bed, or I'm not one of these guys, you know, who knows how to enjoy himself, or I'm not one of these guys that women love in bed. These are all just stories that people manufacture, and they undermine us, and it's important to not tell these stories.
One of the things I love in your book, Sexual Intelligence, is that you talk about knocking down, you know, the goal of having, like, the greatest sex ever, you know, and just having sex be enjoyable. Like, if you go to lunch, it doesn't have to be the greatest lunch ever. You want to go to a good restaurant and everything, but, you're going to have a good time eating. And so what are some ways that people can change their thinking on that? Is it just realizing that?
Well, just realizing it is a big step for most people, and yes, just realizing that's a big deal. But I think it's very hard to not do something. It's much easier to do something. So when I tell people, you know, instead of saying I'm not going to think of a carrot, say I'm going to think of an eggplant. You know, it's much easier to think of an eggplant than it is to not think of a carrot. So if we're not going to focus on telling these self-destructive stories to ourselves, if we're not going to focus on our normality anxiety, if we're not going to focus on our desire to be the best lover in the history of the world, if we're not going to focus on, I hope that I'm as good in bed as my partner's last boyfriend or girlfriend, what are we going to focus on? That's the question. Not what are we not going to focus on, but what are we going to focus on? And so that would be first and foremost your physical experience during sex. How do you feel in your fingers, in your toes, between your legs? You know, how does your face feel? How does your mouth feel? What is your mouth tasting? What is your nose smelling? Those things are readily available, and a lot of people just sort of skip over that stuff. So that's the first thing to focus on. The second thing to focus on is if there's any sort of emotional connection with your partner. And it doesn't have to be. You could go to a bar, pick up a stranger, go home, have sex. Thank you very much. Or you could be in a variety of sexual situations where you don't feel especially close to your partner. But if you do feel close to your partner, or if you want to feel close to your partner, focus on that. That's the second thing that's usually available to focus on, in addition to your physical experience, your emotional or your psychological connection with the other person. Now, when you focus a lot on either of those two things or on both of those two things, that's a lot of stuff to focus on. And that shoves away, that shoves out thoughts about, oh, I hope I get it up. Oh, I hope my boobs aren't too saggy. Oh, I hope I don't call out the wrong name during sex, you know. That shoves out a lot of that extraneous stuff. So rather than say, don't think about A, B, and C, I say focus on X, Y, and Z. And I work with people to help them do that. And some people are anxious about that, and so we work with that.
Another thing I love that you do is that you help people redefine sexy. That you say that you can expand definitions or create new definitions of what is sexy instead of just being stuck in the sort of cultural, the common cultural ones.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. You know, to go back to sushi for a second, I mean, when I was growing up, you know, the whole idea of eating raw food was disgusting. You know, and then I realized, oh, sushi's not raw food. Sushi is sushi, right?
Yeah.
So it's raw food is not to be eaten. Sushi is to be eaten. And that's just a trick of definition. And we have that skill. We do that sort of thing all the time. And you do that when you try a new food, or you do that when you – I mean – when I was growing up, women never, ever, ever let their bra strap show in public. You know, that was considered really gauche and sloppy and, you know, what's wrong with that person? Don't they own a mirror? And now, you know, women, especially younger women, you know, do that routinely. They say, well, of course I do that. It's not even a category of what I do. It's just, you know, the way that you look in the world. So people of a certain age, you know, when women started to walk around with their bra strap showing, we had to start figuring out, okay, so how are we going to relate to this? Are we going to think, well, all of a sudden there's jillions of really sloppy, whorish women in the world? or maybe this is like a new style, or maybe they just don't give a darn. So, you know, there's another example of just changing categories, creating new categories, letting go of old categories. I mean, a lot of people, when they're growing up, if you're old enough, you learn that, you know, oral sex is something that only prostitutes do. Now it turns out it's something that almost everybody does. And so the old idea that oral sex is only what prostitutes do or only what the French do, the public has, in America, the public has really changed its attitudes about that. The same way that the American public is changing its attitudes about anal sex too. Or, I encourage people as an alternative to intercourse, if they want to, they can, you know, he can stroke his penis, while his partner is kissing him. Or, you know, his partner, if it's a woman, you know, or a man or whatever, you know, your partner can stroke themselves while you cuddle them or kiss them or, you know, put your finger in their ear or whatever it is. And people say, oh, masturbate with my partner? I said, no, you're not masturbating with your partner. Masturbation is what you do when you're by yourself. No, you're touching yourself with your partner. That's a sexy thing. So people have the ability to change their ideas if they want to. And some people want to and some people don't.
I love that about your book. It revolutionizes so much thinking, you know, in terms of masturbation, all these things that people have fear and shame about. And one of the wonderful things you say is that you need to know your conditions for good sex. What does that mean?
Well, everybody has conditions for good sex, just like everybody has good conditions for a good restaurant experience. You know, for some people, if the food is perfect but the chairs are uncomfortable, they can't have a good experience. For other people, you know, they don't care about the chairs, they don't care about the silverware, they don't care about the music. If the food is perfect, then that's all they care about. They could be with the person they hate, but if the food is perfect, that's what they care about. Other people, they don't care that much about the food. They want good service. You know, they want to be in a place where they feel taken care of or special. And it's the same thing with sex. You know, for some people, they need privacy. Other people don't need that. For some people, they need a perfectly clean house. Other people don't need that. For some people, they want to be freshly showered. Other people don't need that. And there's no right and wrong about this. It's just, you know, different people are different. The trick is that you have to know what your conditions are, and you have to be able to convey them to your partner without making your partner wrong. So you say to your partner, you don't say to your partner, you know, what kind of an idiot doesn't brush their teeth before sex? No. You say, sweetheart, I would enjoy this more if we both brush our teeth before we have sex. And or instead of saying, what kind of an idiot doesn't brush the cracker crumbs out of bed before sex? You say, you know, honey, for me, having a clean environment just makes sex so much nicer. So being able to convey to the other person, this is what works for me, it's idiosyncratic to me, lets us collaborate on this so that we can have a great time. That's a real important skill.
This is just wonderful. We are about out of time, and I just wanted to ask you if there's some one statement that you have, the advice that you would give people about how to change, how to become sexually intelligent, what they can do to improve their sex lives and to communicate better.
I would encourage people to ask themselves, what exactly is it that I want from this sexual experience? Not so much in terms of where do I want the other person to put their fingers, but what kind of an experience do I want to have? And to make sure that your partner knows that on one level or another, what kind of experience do you want to have? Do you want to feel connected? Do you want pleasure? Do you want to feel like you're exploring the universe? And just convey that in a real simple way to your partner. And then, you know, create experiences that support those goals and de-emphasize experiences that don't support those goals, regardless of what you learned when you were 19 about what real sex is or a real man is or a real woman is.
That's really wonderful. Thank you so much. This has been Advice Goddess Radio. I've been speaking with therapist and sex therapist Dr. Marty Klein, author of the new book, Sexual Intelligence, What We Really Want from Sex and How to Get It. Marty, thank you so much. This has just been a wonderful show with you.
Amy, thank it's you. My pleasure. Thank you.
Don't wait. Get this limited-time holiday offer only from Fios. Click the banner to get incredibly fast 150-meg internet, TV, and phone for only $79.99 per month online for the first year. Plus, you'll get a $200 Visa prepaid card with a two-year agreement. This offer is now extended to December 16th.
Christmas is over, but the deals keep coming at Old Navy. Like today, get 50% off all jeans. Every style you love for adults and kids is 50% off. But you'd better hurry. It's just one day today. Run to Old Navy. Valid 12/26.